1. The Plains of Ilium. Rage. Sing, O muse, of the rage of Achilles, of Peleus' son, murderous man-killer fated to die. Sing of the rage that cost the Achaeans so many good men and sent so many vital, hearty souls down to the dreary house of death. And while you're at it, O muse, sing of the rage of the gods themselves, so petulant and so powerful here on their new Olympus, and of the rage of the post-humans, dead and gone though they might be, and of the rage of those few true humans left, self-absorbed and useless though they may have become. While you are singing, O muse, sing also of the rage of those thoughtful, sentient, serious but not so close to human beings out there, dreaming under the ice of Europa, dying in the sulfur ash of Io, and being born in the cold folds of Ganymede. Oh, and sing of me, O muse, poor born again against his will Hockenberry, poor dead Thomas Hockenberry, Ph.D., Hockenbush to his friends, to friends long since turned to dust on a world long since left behind. Sing of my rage, yes, of my rage, O muse. Small and insignificant though that rage may be, when measured against the anger of the immortal gods, or when compared to the wrath of the god-killer Achilles. On second thought, O muse, sing of nothing to me. I know you, I have been bound and servant to you, O muse, you incomparable bitch, and I do not trust you, O muse, not one little bit. If I am to be the unwilling chorus of this tale, then I can start the story anywhere I choose. I choose to start it here. It is a day like every other day in the more than 9 years since my rebirth. I awaken at the Scolia Barracks, that place of red sand and blue sky and great stone faces. I'm summoned by the muse. Get sniffed and passed by the murderous Cerberids. Am duly carried the 17 vertical miles to the grassy summits of Olympus via the high-speed East Slope crystal escalator, and once reported in at the muse's empty villa, receive my briefing from the Skullic going off shift, don my morphing gear and impact armor, slide the taser baton into my belt, and then QT to the evening plains of Ilium. If you've ever imagined the siege of Ilium, as I did professionally for more than 20 years, I have to tell you that your imagination almost certainly was not up to the task. Mine wasn't. The reality is far more wonderful and terrible than even the blind poet would have us see. First of all, there is the city Ilium, Troy, one of the great armed polis of the ancient world, more than 2 miles away from the beach where I stand now, but still visible and beautiful and domineering on its high ground, its tall walls lighted by thousands of torches and bonfires, its towers not quite as topless as Marlowe would have us believe, but still amazing, tall, rounded, alien, imposing. Then there are the Achaeans and Danaans and other invaders, technically not yet Greeks, since that nation will not come into being for more than 2,000 years, but I will call them Greeks anyway, stretched mile after mile here along the shoreline. When I taught the Iliad, I told my students that the Trojan War, for all its Homeric glory, had probably been a small affair in reality, some few thousands of Greek warriors against a few thousand Trojans. Even the best informed members of the Scolia, that group of Iliad scholars going back almost 2 millennia, estimated from the poem that there could not possibly be more than 50,000 Achaeans and other Greek warriors drawn up in their black ships along the shore.
They were wrong. Estimates now show that there are more than 250,000 attacking Greeks, and about half that number of defending Trojans and their allies. Evidently every warrior hero in the Greek Isles came running to this battle, for battle meant plunder, and brought his soldiers and allies and retainers and slaves and concubines with him. The visual impact is stunning. Mile upon mile of lighted tents, campfires, sharpened stake defenses. Miles of trenches dug in the hard ground above the beaches. not for hiding and hunkering in, but as a deterrent to Trojan cavalry, and illuminating all those miles of tents and men and shining on polished spears and bright shields, thousands of bonfires and cooking fires and corpse fires burning bright. Corpse fires. For the past few weeks, pestilence has been creeping through the Greek ranks, first killing donkeys and dogs, then dropping a soldier here, a servant there, until suddenly, in the past 10 days, it has become an epidemic, slaying more Achaean and Danaan heroes than the defenders of Ilium have in months. I suspect it is typhus. The Greeks are sure it is the anger of Apollo. I've seen Apollo from a distance, both on Olympus and here, and he's a very nasty fellow. Apollo is the archer god, lord of the silver bow, he who strikes from afar. And while he's the god of healing, he's also the god of disease. More than that, he's the principal divine ally of the Trojans in this battle, and if Apollo were to have his way, the Achaeans would be wiped out. Whether this typhoid came from the corpse-fouled rivers and other polluted water here or from Apollo's silver bow, the Greeks are right to think that he wishes them ill. At this moment, the Achaean lords and kings, and every one of these Greek heroes is a sort of king or lord in his own province and in his own eyes, are gathering in a public assembly near Agamemnon's tent to decide on a course of action to end this plague. I walk that way slowly, almost reluctantly, although after more than 9 years of biding my time, tonight should be the most exciting moment of my long observation of this war. Tonight, Homer's Iliad begins in reality. Oh, I've witnessed many elements from Homer's poem that had been poetically misplaced in time, such as the so-called catalogue of ships, the assembly and listing of all the Greek forces, which is in Book 2 of the Iliad, but which I saw take place more than 9 years ago during the assembly of this military expedition at Aulis, the strait between Euboea and the Greek mainland, or the Epipolesis, the review of the army by Agamemnon, which occurs in Book 4 of Homer's epic, but which I saw take place shortly after the armies landed here near Ilium. That actual event was followed by what I used to teach as the Tachoscopia, or the view from the wall in which Helen identifies the various Achaean heroes for Priam and the other Trojan leaders. The Tachoscopia appears in Book 3 of the poem, but happened shortly after the landing and Epipolesis in the actual unfolding of events. If there is an actual unfolding of events here. At any rate, tonight is the assembly at Agamemnon's tent and the confrontation between Agamemnon and Achilles. This is where the Iliad begins, and it should be the focus of all my energies and professional skills, but the truth is that I don't really give a shit. Let them posture, let them bluster. Let Achilles reach for his sword. Well, I confess that I'm interested in observing that. Will Athena actually appear to stop him, or was she just a metaphor for Achilles' common sense kicking in? I've waited my entire life to answer such a question, and the answer is only minutes away. But strangely, irrevocably, I don't give a shit. The 9 years of painful rebirth and slow memory return and constant warfare and constant heroic posturing, not to mention my own enslavement by the gods and the muse, have taken their toll. I'd be just as happy right now if a B-52 appeared and dropped an atomic bomb on both the Greeks and the Trojans. Fuck all these heroes and the wooden chariots they rode in on. But I trudge toward Agamemnon's tent. This is my job. If I don't observe this and make my report to the muse, it won't mean loss of tenure for me. The gods will reduce me to the bone splinters and dusty DNA they recreated me from, and that, as they say, will be that. 2. Artis Hills, Artis Hall. Demon faxed into solidity near Ada's home and blinked stupidly at the red sun on the horizon. The sky was cloudless and the sunset burned between the tall trees on the ridgeline and set both the P-ring and the E-ring glowing as they rotated in the cobalt sky. Demon was disoriented because it was evening here and it had been morning only a second before when he faxed away from Toby's second 20 party in Ulaanbaat. It had been years since he visited Ada's home, and except for those friends whom he visited most regularly, Sedman in Paris, Ono in Belenbad, Risser in her home on the cliffs of Chom, a few others, he never had a clue as to what continent or time zone he would find himself in. But then, Demon did not know the names or positions of the continents, much less the concepts of geography or time zones, so his very lack of knowledge meant nothing to him. It was still disorienting. He had lost a day, or had he gained it? At any rate, the air smelled different here, wetter, richer, wilder. Demon looked around. He stood in the center of a generic fax node pad, that usual circle of permcrete and fancy iron posts topped with a yellow crystal pergola, and near the center of the circle the post holding the inevitable coded sign that he could not read. There was no other structure visible in the valley, only grass, trees, a stream in the distance, the slow revolution of both rings crossing above like the armatures of some great slow gyroscope. It was a warm evening, more humid than Ulaanbaat, and the fax pad was centered in a grassy meadow surrounded by low hills. 20 feet beyond the pad circle stood an ancient two-person, one-wheeled open carryall with an equally ancient servitor floating above the driver's nook and a single voynix standing between the wooden tongues. It had been more than a decade since Demon had visited Artis Hall, but now he remembered the barbaric inconvenience of all this. Absurd. Not having one's home on a fax node. "Demon Ur?" queried the servitor, although it obviously knew who he was. Demon grunted and held out his battered Gladstone. The tiny servitor floated closer, took the luggage in its padded cusps, and loaded it in the carryall's canvas boot while Demon climbed aboard. "Are we waiting for others?" "You are the final guest," replied the servitor. It hummed into its hemispherical niche and clicked a command. The voynix clamped onto the carryall tongues and began jogging toward the setting sun, its rusty peds and the carryall's wheel raising very little dust on the gravel roadway. Demon settled back on the green leather, rested both hands on his walking cane, and enjoyed the ride. He had come not to visit Ada, but to seduce her. This is what Demon did, seduce young women. That and collect butterflies. The fact that Ada was in her mid-20s and Demon was approaching his second 20 made no difference to him. Neither did the fact that Ada was his first cousin. Incest taboos had eroded away long ago. Genetic drift was not even a concept to Demon, but if it had been, he would have trusted the firmary to fix it. The firmary fixed everything. Demon had been visiting Artis Hill 10 years earlier in his role as cousin and trying to seduce Ada's other cousin, Virginia, out of sheer boredom since Virginia had all the attractiveness of a voynix, when he had first seen Ada nude. He had been walking down one of the endless Artis Hall corridors in search of the breakfast conservatory when he had passed the younger woman's room. The door was ajar, and there reflected in a tall, warped mirror was Ada, bathing from a basin with a sponge and wearing only a mildly bored expression. Ada was many things, but overly hygienic was not one, Demon had learned. And her reflection, this young woman just emerging from the chrysalis of girlhood, had arrested him, this adult man, just a bit older then than Ada was now. Even then, with the puffiness of childhood still present in her hips and thighs and bud-nipple breasts, Ada was a sight worth stopping to appreciate. Pale, the girl's skin stayed a soft, parchment white no matter how long she stayed outside. Her gray eyes, raspberry lips, and black hair was an amateur eroticist's dream. The cultural mode had been for women to shave their armpits then, but neither young Ada nor, Demon sincerely hoped, her adult counterpart had paid any more attention to that than she did to most other cultural modalities. Frozen in the tall mirror then, and pinned and mounted in the collection tray of Demon's memory now, was that still girlish but already voluptuous body, heavy pale breasts, creamy skin, alert eyes, all that paleness punctuated by the 4 dashes of black hair. The wavy question mark of hair she kept carelessly pinned up except when she played, which was most of the time. The 2 commas under her arms and the perfect black exclamation mark, not yet matured to a delta leading to the shadows between her thighs. Riding in the carryall, Demon smiled. He had no idea why Ada had invited him to this birthday celebration after all these years, or whose 20 they were celebrating, but he was confident that he would seduce the young woman before he faxed back to his real world of parties and long visits and casual affairs with more worldly women. The voynix trotted effortlessly, pulling the carryall with only the gravel hiss underped and the soft humming of ancient gyroscopes in the carriage body. Shadows crept across the valley, but the narrow lane went up over a ridge, caught the last bit of the sun, bisected as it was on the next ridge west, and then descended into a wider valley where fields of some low crop stretched out on either side. The tending servitors flitted above the field, Demon thought, like so many levitating croquet balls. The road turned south, left to Demon, crossed a river on a wooden-covered bridge, and then switched back up a steeper hill and entered an older forest. Demon vaguely remembered hunting for butterflies in that ancient forest 10 years ago, later on the day he had seen young Ada nude in the mirror. He remembered his excitement at collecting a rare breed of mourning cloak near a waterfall, the memory mingling with the excitement at seeing the girl's pale flesh and black hair. He remembered now the look Ada's reflection had given him when the pale face looked up from her ablutions. Disinterested, neither pleased nor angry, immodest but not brazen, vaguely clinical, looking at 27-year-old Demon frozen by lust in the hallway, much the way Demon himself had studied his captured mourning cloak. The carryall was nearing Arda's Hall. It was dark under the ancient oaks and elms and ash trees nearing the top of the hill, but yellow lanterns had been set along the roadway, and lines of colored lanterns could be glimpsed in the primeval forest, perhaps outlining trails. The Voynichs padded out of the woods, and a twilight view opened up. Arda's Hall glowing on its hilltop, white gravel paths and roads winding away from it in every direction. The long, grassy sward extending down from the manor house for more than a quarter mile before the greenway was blocked by another forest. The river beyond, still glowing, reflecting the dying light in the sky, and through a gap in the hills to the southwest, glimpses of more forested hills, black, devoid of lights, and then more hills beyond that, until the black ridges blended with dark clouds on the horizon. Demon shivered. He hadn't remembered until that minute that Ada's home was somewhere near the dinosaur forests on whatever continent this was. He remembered being terrified during his previous visit, although Virginia and Vanessa and all the rest had assured him that no dangerous dinosaurs were within 500 miles, all the rest being reassuring, that is, except for 15-year-old Ada, who had merely looked at him with that calculating, mildly amused look he soon learned was her habitual expression. It had taken butterflies to get him outdoors for a walk then. It would take more now. Even though he knew it was perfectly safe with the servitors and Voynichs around, Demon had no urge at all to be eaten by an extinct reptile and to wake up in the infirmary with the memory of that indignity. The giant elm on the downhill side of Arda's Hall had been festooned with scores of lanterns. Torches lined the circular drive and the white gravel paths from the house to the yard. Sentinel Voynichs stood along the driveway hedges and at the edge of the dark woods. Demon saw that a long table had been set out near the elm tree, torches flickering in the evening breeze all around the festive setting, and that a few guests were already gathering there for dinner. Demon also noted, with his usual hint of pleased snobbery, that most of the men here were still dressing in off-white robes, burnouses, and earth-tone evening oversuits, a style that had gone out of fashion months ago in the more important social circles Demon inhabited. The Voynichs padded up the circular drive to the front doors of Arda's Hall, stopped in the shaft of yellow light from those doors, and set the carryall tongues down so gently that Demon did not even feel a bump. The servitor flitted around to fetch his bag while Demon stepped down, glad to feel his feet on the ground, still feeling a bit lightheaded from the day's faxing. Ada swept out the door and down the stairs to greet him. Demon stopped in his tracks and smiled stupidly. Ada was not only more beautiful than he remembered, she was more beautiful than he could have imagined. 3. The Plains of Ilium. The Greek commanders are gathered outside Agamemnon's tent. There is a crowd of interested onlookers and the brawl between Agamemnon. I should mention that by this time I have morphed into the form of Bias. Not the Pylian captain of that name in Nestor's ranks, but the captain serving Menestheus. This poor Athenian is ill with typhoid during this period, and though he will survive to fight in Book 13, he rarely leaves his tent, which is far down the coast.
As a captain, Bias has enough rank that the spearmen and curious bystanders give way for him, allowing me access to the center circle. But no one will expect Bias to speak during the coming debate. I've missed most of the drama where Calchas, Vestor's son and the clearest of all the seers, has told the Achaeans the real reason for Apollo's wrath. Another captain standing there whispers to me that Calchas had requested immunity before speaking, demanding that Achilles protect him if the assembled crowd and kings disliked what he had to say. Achilles has agreed. Calchas told the group what they half suspected, that Chryse, the priest of Apollo, had begged for the return of his captured daughter, and Agamemnon's refusal had infuriated the god. Agamemnon had been angry at the Calchas interpretation. "He shits square goat turds," whispered the captain with a wine-scented laugh. "This captain, unless I am mistaken, is named Oris, and will be killed by Hector in a few weeks when the Trojan hero begins massacring Achaeans by the gross. Oris tells me that Agamemnon agreed just minutes ago to give back the slave girl Chryseis. I rank her higher and like her better than Clytemnestra, my own wife," Atreus' son Agamemnon had shouted. But then the king had demanded recompense in the form of an equally beautiful captive girl. According to Oris, who is three sheets to the wind, Achilles had shouted, "Wait a minute, Agamemnon, you most grasping man alive!" Pointed out that the Argives, still another name for the Achaeans, the Danaans, the damned Greeks with so many names, were in no position to hand over more booty to their leader now. Someday, should the tide of battle turn back their direction, promised the man-killer Achilles, Agamemnon would get his girl. In the meantime, he told Agamemnon to give Chryseis back to her father and to shut up. "At that point, Lord Agamemnon, Atreus' son, began shitting whole goats," laughs Oris, speaking loudly enough that several captains turn to frown at us. I nod and look at the inner circles. Agamemnon, as always, is in the center of things. Atreus' son looks every inch the supreme commander. Tall, beard rolled in classic curls, a demigod's brow and piercing eyes, muscles oiled, dressed in the finest gear and garb. Directly opposite him, in the open bullseye of the circle, stands Achilles. Stronger, younger, even more beautiful than Agamemnon, Achilles almost defies description. When I first saw him at the catalog of the ships more than 9 years ago, I thought that Achilles had to be the most godlike human walking among these many godlike men. So imposing was the man's physical and command presence. Since then I've realized that for all his beauty and power, Achilles is relatively stupid, a sort of infinitely more handsome Arnold Schwarzenegger. Around this inner circle are the heroes I spent decades teaching about in my other life. They do not disappoint when encountered in the flesh. Near Agamemnon, but obviously not siding with him in the argument now raging, is Odysseus. A full head shorter than Agamemnon, but broader in the chest and shoulders, moving among the Greek lords like a ram among sheep. His intelligence and craftiness visible in his eyes and etched into the lines on his weathered face. I've never spoken to Odysseus, but I look forward to doing so before this war ends and he leaves on his travels. On Agamemnon's right is his younger brother Menelaus, Helen's husband. I wish I had a dollar for every time I've overheard one of the Achaeans gripe that if Menelaus had been a better lover, had a bigger cock, was the way Diomedes crudely put it to a friend within my earshot 3 years ago, then Helen wouldn't have run off with Paris to Ilium, and the heroes of the Greek Isles wouldn't have wasted the past 9 years on this accursed siege. On Agamemnon's left is Orestes, not Agamemnon's son left at home and spoiled, who will someday avenge his father's murder and earn his own play, but only a loyal spear-carrier of the same name who will be slaughtered by Hector during the next big Trojan offensive. Standing behind King Agamemnon is Eurybates, Agamemnon's herald, not to be confused with the Eurybates who is Odysseus' herald. Next to Eurybates stands Ptolemaeus' son, Eurymedon, a handsome boy who is Agamemnon's charioteer, not to be confused with the far less handsome Eurymedon, who is Nestor's charioteer. Sometimes here I admit I'd exchange all these glorious patronymics for a few simple last names. Also in Agamemnon's half of the circle tonight are Big Ajax and Little Ajax, commanders of the troops from Salamis and Locris. These two will never be confused except by name, since Big Ajax looks like a white NFL linebacker, and Little Ajax looks like a pickpocket. Euryalus, third in command of the Argolis fighters, is standing next to his boss, Sthenelus, a man who has such a terrible lisp that he can't pronounce his own name. Agamemnon's friend and the ultimate commander of the Argolis fighters, plain-speaking Diomedes, is also here, not happy tonight, glowering at the ground, his arms folded. Old Nestor, the clear speaker of Pylos, stands near the halfway point of the inner circle and looks even less happy than Diomedes as Agamemnon and Achilles raise the level of their anger and abuse toward one another. If things go according to Homer's telling, Nestor will make his big speech in just a few minutes, trying in vain to shame both Agamemnon and the furious Achilles into reconciling before their anger serves the Trojans' aims. And I confess that I want to hear Nestor's speech, even if just for his reference to the ancient war against the centaurs. Centaurs have always interested me, and Homer has Nestor speak of them and the war against them in a matter-of-fact tone. Centaurs are one of only two mythical beasts mentioned in the Iliad, the other being the Chimera. I look forward to this mention of the centaurs, but in the meantime I stay out of Nestor's sight, since the identity I'm morphing, Bias, is one of the old man's subordinates, and I don't want to be pulled into conversation. No worry of that now. Nestor and everyone else's attention is focused on the exchange of harsh words and spittle between Agamemnon and Achilles. Standing near Nestor and obviously allying themselves with neither leader are Menestheus, who will be killed by Paris in a few weeks if things proceed according to Homer, Eumelus, leader of the Thessalians from Pherae, Polyxenus, co-commander of the Epeans, Polyxenus' friend Thalpius, Thoas, commander of the Aetolians, Leontius and Polypetes in their distinctive Argus and garb, also Machaon and his brother Podalirius with their various Thessalian lieutenants standing behind them. Odysseus' dear friend Lucas, fated to be killed in a few days by Antiphus, and others I've come to know well over the years, not just by sight but by the sound of their voices, as well as by their distinctive modes of fighting and bragging and making offerings to the gods. If I haven't mentioned it yet, the ancient Greeks assembled here do nothing in a half-assed way. Everything is performed to the full extent of their abilities, every effort running what one 20th-century scholar called the full risk of failure. Opposite Agamemnon and standing to the right of Achilles is Patroclus, the man-killer's closest friend, whose death by Hector's hand is fated to set off the true wrath of Achilles and the greatest slaughter in the history of warfare, as well as Tlepolemus, the mythic hero Heracles' beautiful son, who fled his home after killing his father's uncle, and who will soon die by Sarpedon's hand. Between Tlepolemus and Patroclus stands old Phoenix, Achilles' dear friend and former tutor, whispering to the son of Diocles, Orsilochus, who will be killed by Aeneas soon enough. To the raging Achilles' left is Idomeneus, a far closer friend of the man-killers than I had suspected from the poem. There are more heroes in the inner circle, of course, as well as countless more in the mob behind me, but you get the idea. No one goes nameless, either in Homer's epic poem or in the day-to-day reality here on the plains of Ilium. Every man carries his father's name, his history, his lands and wives and children and chattel with him at all times, in all encounters, both martial and rhetorical. It's enough to wear a simple scholar out. All right, godlike Achilles, you cheater at dice, you cheater at war, you cheater with women. Now you are trying to cheat me, Agamemnon is shouting. Oh, no, you don't. You're not going to get past me that way. You have the slave girl, Briseis, as beautiful as any we've taken, as beautiful as my Chryseis. You just want to cling to your prize while I end up empty-handed. Forget it. I'd rather hand over command of the army to Ajax here, or Idomeneus, or crafty Odysseus there, or to you, Achilles, you, rather than be cheated so. Do it then, sneers Achilles. It's time we had a real leader here. Agamemnon's face grows purple. Fine. Haul a black ship down to the sea and fill it with men to row and sacrifices for the gods. Take Chryseis if you dare, but you will have to perform the sacrifices, Achilles, O killer of men. But I know that I'll take a prize as recompense, and that prize will be your lovely Briseis. Achilles' handsome face is contorted with rage. Shameless! You're armored in shamelessness and shrewd in greed, you dog-faced coward! Agamemnon takes a step forward, drops his scepter, and puts a hand on his sword. Achilles matches him step for step and grips the hilt of his own sword. The Trojans have never done us any harm, Agamemnon, but you have. It wasn't the Trojan spearmen who brought us to this shore, but your own greed. We're fighting for you, you colossal heap of shame. We followed you here to win your honor back from the Trojans, yours and your brother Menelaus, a man who can't even keep his wife in the bedroom. Here, Menelaus steps forward and grips his sword. Captains and their men are gravitating to one hero or the other now, so the circle is already broken, turning into three camps. Those who will fight for Agamemnon, those who will fight for Achilles, and those near Odysseus and Nestor, who look disgusted enough to kill both of them. My men and I are leaving, shouts Achilles, back to Thyre. Better to drown in an empty ship heading home in defeat than to stay here and be disgraced, filling Agamemnon's goblet and piling up Agamemnon's plunder. Good! Go, shouts Agamemnon. By all means, desert! I'd never beg you to stay and fight on my account. You're a great soldier, Achilles, but what of it? That's a gift of the gods and has nothing to do with you. You love battle and blood and slaughtering your enemies, so take your fawning myrmidons and go. Agamemnon spits. Achilles actually vibrates with anger. It is obvious that he is torn between the urge to turn on his heel, take his men and leave Ilium forever, and the overwhelming desire to unsheathe his sword and gut Agamemnon like a sacrificial sheep. But now this, Achilles, Agamemnon goes on, his shout dropping to a terrible whisper that can be heard by all the hundreds of men assembled here. Whether you leave or stay, I will give up my Chryseis because the god, Apollo, insists. But I will have your Briseis in her stead. And every man here will know how much greater a man is Agamemnon than the surly boy Achilles. Here Achilles loses all control and goes for his sword in earnest. And here the Iliad would have ended, with the death of Agamemnon or the death of Achilles or of both, and the Achaeans would have sailed home, and Hector would have enjoyed his old age, and Ilium would have remained standing for 1,000 years and perhaps rivaled Rome in its glory. But at this second, the goddess Athena appears behind Achilles. I see her. Achilles reels around, face contorted, and obviously also sees her. No one else can. I don't understand their stealth cloaking technology, but it works when I use it, and it works for the gods. No, I realize immediately, this is more than stealth. The gods have frozen time again. It is their favorite way of talking to their pet human. Others eavesdropping. But I've seen it only a handful of times. Agamemnon's mouth is open. I can see spittle frozen in midair, but no sound is heard, no movement of jaw or muscles, no blinking of those dark eyes. So it is with every man in the circle, frozen, rapt or bemused, frozen. Overhead, a seabird hangs motionless in mid-flight. Waves curl but do not break on the shore. The air is as thick as syrup, and all of us here are frozen like insects in amber. The only movement in this halted universe comes from Pallas Athena, from Achilles, and, even if shown only by my leaning forward to hear better, from me. Achilles' hand is still on the hilt of his sword, half drawn from its beautifully tooled scabbard. But Athena has grabbed him by his long hair and physically turned him toward her, and he does not dare draw the sword now. To do so would be to challenge the goddess herself. But Achilles' eyes are blazing, more mad than sane, as he shouts into the thickened, syrupy silence that accompanies these time freezes, "Why, damn, why now? Why come to me now, goddess, daughter of Zeus? Did you come to witness my humiliation by Agamemnon? Yield, says Athena. If you've never seen a god or goddess, all I can do is tell you that they are larger than life, literally, since Athena must be 7 feet tall, and more beautiful and striking than any mortal. I presume their nanotechnology and recombinant DNA labs made them that way. Athena combines qualities of feminine beauty, divine command, and sheer power that I didn't even know could exist before I found myself returned to existence in the shadow of Olympus. Her hand stays wrapped in Achilles' hair, bending his head back and making him swivel away from frozen Agamemnon and his minions. "I'll never yield," shouts Achilles. Even in this frozen air that slows and mutes all sound, the man-killer's voice is strong. "That pig who thinks he's a king will pay for his arrogance with his life." "Yield," says Athena for the second time. "The white-armed goddess Hera sped me down from the skies to stop your rage. Yield!" I can see a flicker of hesitation enter Achilles' crazed eyes. Hera, Zeus's wife, is the strongest ally of the Achaeans on Olympus and a patroness of Achilles since his odd childhood. "Stop this fighting now," orders Athena. "Take your hand off your sword, Achilles. Curse Agamemnon if you must, but do not kill him. Do what we command now, and I promise you this." "I know this is the truth, Achilles, just as I see your fate and know the future of all mortal men. Obey us now, and one day, glittering gifts, three times this will be yours as payment for this outrage. Defy us and die this hour. Obey us both, Hera and me, and receive your reward." Achilles grimaces, twists his hair free, looks sullen, but resheathes his sword. Watching Athena and him is like watching two living forms amidst a field of statues. "I can't defy both of you, goddess," says Achilles. "Better if a man submits to the will of the gods, even if his heart breaks with anger. But it is only fair, then, that the gods hear the prayers of that man." Athena twitches the slightest of smiles and winks out of existence, QTing back to Olympus, and time resumes. Agamemnon is ending his harangue. Sword sheathed, Achilles steps into the empty circle. "You drunken wine skin of a man," cries the man-killer. "You with your dog's eyes and your deer's heart. You leader who's never led us into battle or gone into ambush with the best of the Achaeans. You who lack the courage to sack Ilium, and so must sack the tents of his army for plunder instead. You king who rules only the most worthless husks among us. I promise you this. I swear a mighty oath this day."
The hundreds of men around me take in a breath almost as one, more shocked by this promise of a curse than if Achilles had simply cut Agamemnon down like a dog.
"I swear to you that someday a great yearning for Achilles will come to all the sons of Achaea," shouts the man-killer, his voice so loud that it halts dice games 100 yards away in the tent city. "To all of them, throughout your armies here. But then, Atrides, stricken to your soul, though you'll be nothing you do will save you. Sigh, and on that day you will tear out your own heart and eat it, desperate, raging that you chose to do such dishonor to the best of all the Achaeans." And with that, Achilles turns on his famous heel and strides from the circle, crunching across seashore gravel back into the darkness between the tents. I have to admit, it was one hell of an exit line. Agamemnon crosses his arms and shakes his head. Other men speak in shocked tones. Nestor steps forward to give his "In the days of the Centaur Wars we all pulled together" speech. This is an anomaly. Homer has Achilles still in the argument when Nestor speaks, and my skullic mind makes note of it, but most of my attention is far, far away. It's at this instant, remembering the murderous gaze that Achilles had turned on Athena in the instant before she wrenched his hair back and cowed him into submission, that a plan of action so audacious, so obviously doomed to failure, so suicidal and so wonderful opens before me that for a minute I have trouble breathing. "Bias, are you all right?" asks Oris, standing next to me. I stare blankly at the man. For a minute, I cannot remember who he is or who Bias is, forgetting my own morphed identity. I shake my head and push my way out of the circled throng of glorious killers. The gravel crunches under my feet without the heroic echo of Achilles' exit. I walk toward the water, and once out of sight, throw off the identity of Bias. Anyone seeing me now would see the middle-aged Thomas Hockenberry, spectacles and all, weighted down in the absurd garb of an Achaean spearman, wool and fur covering my morphing gear and impact armor. The ocean is dark. Wine dark, I think, but fail to amuse myself. I have the overwhelming urge, not for the first time, to use my cloaking ability and levitation harness to fly away from here, to soar over Ilium a final time, to stare down at its torches and doomed inhabitants a final time, and then fly south and west across that wine-dark sea, the Aegean, until I come to the not-yet-Greek isles and mainland. I could check in on Clytemnestra and on Penelope, on Telemachus and Orestes. Professor Thomas Hockenberry, as both boy and man, always got along better with women and children than he did with male adults. But these proto-Greek women and children here are more murderous and bloodthirsty than any adult males Hockenberry had known in his other bloodless life. Save the flying away, then, for another day. In fact, put it behind me altogether. The waves roll in one after another, reassuring in their familiar cadence. I will do this thing. The decision comes with the exhilaration of flying. No, not of flying, but in the thrill of that brief instance of zero gravity one achieves when throwing oneself from a high place and knowing that there is no going back to solid ground. Sink or swim, fall or fly. I will do this thing. 4. Near Connemara Chaos. Monmouth, the European Moravec submersible, was 3 kilometers ahead of the Kraken and gaining, which should have created some sense of confidence in the diminutive robotic organic construct, but since Kraken often had tentacles 5 kilometers long, it didn't. It was an aggravation. Worse than that, it was a distraction. Monmouth had almost finished with his new analysis of Sonnet 116, was eager to email it to Orfu on Io, and the last thing he needed now was to have his submersible swallowed. He pinged the Kraken, verified that the huge, hungry, jellied mass was still in flagellant pursuit, and interfaced with the reactor long enough to add another 3 knots to his ship's speed. The Kraken, which was literally out of its depth here, so close to the Connemara Chaos region and its open leads, flailed to keep up. Monmouth knew that as long as they were both traveling at this speed, the Kraken would be unable to extend its tentacles to full reach to engulf the submersible. But if his little sub were to encounter something, say a big wad of flashlight kelp, and he had to slow, or worse yet, got fouled in the glowing strands of goo, then the Kraken would be on him like a... Oh, well, damn, said Monmouth, abandoning any attempt at simile, and speaking aloud to the humming silence of the submersible's cramped environmental cavity. His sensors were plugged into the ship's systems, and virtual vision showed him huge clumps of flashlight kelp dead ahead. The glowing colonies were floating along the isothermal currents here, feeding on the reddish veins of magnesium sulfate that rose to the ice shelf above, like so many bloody taproots. Monmouth thought, dive, and the submersible dived 20 clicks deeper, clearing the lower colonies of kelp by only a few dozen meters. The Kraken dived behind him. If a Kraken could grin, it would be grinning now. This was its killing depth. Monmouth reluctantly cleared Sonnet 116 from his visual field and considered his options. Being eaten by a Kraken less than 100 kilometers from Connemara Chaos Central would be embarrassing. It was these damn bureaucrats' fault. They needed to cull their local subseas of monsters before they ordered one of their Moravec explorers back to a meeting. He could kill the Kraken, but with no harvester submersible within 1,000 clicks, The beautiful beastie would be torn to shreds and devoured by the parasites in the flashlight kelp colonies, by salt sharks, by free-floating tube worms, and by other crocken long before a company harvester could get near it. It would be a terrible waste. Monmouth pulled his vision out of virtual long enough to look around his enviro-niche, as if a glimpse of his cluttered reality could give him an idea. It did. On his console desk, along with the leather-bound volumes of Shakespeare and the Vendler printout, was his lava lamp, a little joke from his old Moravec partner, Ertzweil, almost 20 J-years ago. Monmouth smiled and re-engaged virtual along all bandwidths. This close to Chaos Central, there would have to be diapirs, and Crocken hated diapirs. Yes, 15 clicks south by southeast, an entire belch field of them rising slowly toward the cap ice, just as languidly as the wax blobs did in his lava lamp. Monmouth set his course to the nearest diapir rising to a lead, and added 5 more knots just to be safe. If there was such a thing as safety within tentacle range of a mature Crocken. A diapir was nothing more than a blob of warm ice, heated by the vents and gravitational hot zones far below, rising through the Epsom Salt Sea toward the ice cap that had once covered 100% of Europa, and which now, 2,000 E-years after the Cryobot Arbiter Company arrived, still covered more than 98% of the moon. This diapir was about 15 clicks across and rising rapidly as it approached the surface cap. Crocken did not like the electrolytic properties of diapirs. They refused to foul even their probe tentacles with the stuff, much less their killing arms and maws. Monmouth's sub reached the rising blob a good 10 kilometers ahead of the pursuing Crocken, slowed, morphed its outer hull to impact strength, pulled in sensors and probes, and bored into the glob of slush. Monmouth used sonar and EPS to check the lenticulae and navigation leads still some 8,000 meters above him. In a few minutes, the diapir itself would mush into the thick cap ice, flow upward through fissures, lenticulae and leads, and bubble slush ice in a fountain 100 meters high. For a short time, this part of Connemara Chaos would look like Lost Age America's Yellowstone Park, with red sulfur geysers geysing and hot springs boiling. Then the spray trail would disperse in Europa's 1/7 Earth gravity, fall like a slow-motion slush storm for kilometers on either side of each surface lenticula, and then freeze in Europa's thin, artificial atmosphere, all 100 millibars of it, adding more abstract sculptural forms to the already tortured ice fields. Monmouth couldn't be killed in literal terms. Although part organic, he existed rather than lived, and he was designed tough. But he definitely did not want to become part of a fountain or a frozen chunk of an abstract sculpture for the next 1,000 E-years. For a minute, he forgot both the Crocken and Sonnet 116 as he worked the numbers. The diapir's ascent rate, his submersible's forward progress through the slush, the fast-approaching cap ice, and then he downloaded his thoughts to the engine room and ballast tanks. If it worked right, he would exit the south side of the diapir half a click before glob impact with the ice and accelerate straight ahead, doing an emergency surface blow just as the tidal wave from the diapir fountain was forced down the lead. He would then use that 100-click-per-hour acceleration to keep him ahead of the fountain effect, essentially using his submersible like a surfboard for half the distance to Connemara Chaos Central. He'd have to make the final 20 clicks or so to the base on the surface after the tidal wave dissipated, but he had no choice. It should be one hell of an entrance. Unless something had blocked the lead ahead, or unless another submersible was coming out lead from Central, that would be embarrassing for the few seconds before Monmouth and the Dark Lady were destroyed. At least the Crocken would no longer be a factor. The critters refused to rise closer than 5 clicks to the surface cap. Having entered all the commands and knowing that he'd done everything he could think of to survive and arrive at the base on time, Monmouth went back to his sonnet analysis. Monmouth's submersible, which he had long ago named the Dark Lady, cruised the last 20 kilometers to Connemara Chaos Central, down a kilometer-wide lead, riding on the surface of the Black Sea beneath a black sky. A three-quarters Jupiter was rising, clouds bright and cloud bands roiling with muted colors, while a tiny Io skittered across the rising giant's face not far above the icy horizon. On either side of the lead, striated ice cliffs rose several hundred meters, their sheer faces dull gray and blunted red against the black sky. Monmouth was excited as he brought Shakespeare's sonnet up. Sonnet 116. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error, and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. Over the decades he had come to hate this sonnet. It was the kind of things humans had recited at their weddings way back in the lost age. It was smarmy. It was schlocky. It wasn't good Shakespeare. But finding micro-records of critical writings by a woman named Helen Vendler, a critic who had lived and written in one of those centuries, the 19th or 20th or 21st, the record timestamps were vague, had given Monmouth a key to translating this sonnet. What if Sonnet 116 was not, as it had been portrayed for so many centuries, a sticky affirmation, but a violent refutation? Monmouth went back through his notated key words for support. There they were, from each line. Not, not, no, never, not, not, not. And then in line 14, never, nor, and no. Echoing King Lear's nihilistic, never, 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 never. It was definitely a poem of refutation. But refutation of what? Monmouth knew that Sonnet 116 was part of the young man cycle, but he also knew that the phrase, the young man, was little more than a fig leaf added in later, more prudish years. The love poems were not sent to a man, but to the youth. Certainly a boy, probably no older than 13. Monmouth had read the criticism from the second half of the 20th century, and knew these scholars thought the sonnets to be literal. That is, real homosexual letters from the playwright Shakespeare. But Monmouth also knew from more scholarly work in previous eras, and in the later part of the lost age, that such politically motivated literal thinking was childish. Shakespeare had structured a drama in his sonnets, Monmouth was certain of that. The youth and the later Dark Lady were characters in that drama. The sonnets had taken years to write and had not been produced in the heat of passion, but in the maturity of Shakespeare's full powers. And what was he exploring in these sonnets? Love. And what were Shakespeare's real opinions about love? No one would ever know. Monmouth was sure the bard was too clever, too cynical, too stealthy ever to show his true feelings. But in play after play, Shakespeare had shown how strong feelings, including love, turned people into fools. Shakespeare, like Lear, loved his fools. Romeo had been fortune's fool. Hamlet, fate's fool. Macbeth, ambition's fool. Falstaff? Well, Falstaff was no one's fool, but he became a fool for the love of Prince Hal, and died of a broken heart when the young prince abandoned him. Monmouth knew that the poet in the sonnet cycles, sometimes referred to as Will, was not, despite the insistence of so many of the shallow scholars of the 20th century, the historical Will Shakespeare, but was, rather, another dramatic construct created by the playwright-poet to explore all the facets of love. What if this poet was, like Shakespeare's hapless Count Orsino, love's fool? A man in love with love? Mama liked this approach. He knew that Shakespeare's marriage of two minds between the older poet and the youth was not a homosexual liaison, but a true sacrament of sensibilities, a facet of love honored in days long preceding Shakespeare's. On the surface, Sonnet 116 seemed to be a trite declaration of that love and its permanency, but if it truly was a refutation, Monmouth suddenly saw where it fit. Like so many great poets, Shakespeare began his poems before or after they began. But if this was a poem of refutation, what was it refuting? What had the youth said to the older, love-besotted poet that needed such vehement refutation? Monmouth extended fingers from his primary manipulator, took up his stylus, and scribbled on his tea slate. "Dear Will, certainly we'd both like the marriage of true minds we have, since men cannot share the sacramental marriage of bodies, to be as real and permanent as real marriage. But it can't be. People change, Will. Circumstances change. When the qualities of people or the people themselves go away, one's love does as well. I loved you once, Will. I really did, but you've changed. You've altered. And so there has been a change in me and an alteration in our love. Yours most sincerely, the youth." Monmouth looked at his letter and laughed, but the laughter died as he realized how this changed all of Sonnet 116. Now, instead of a treacly affirmation of unchanging love, the sonnet became a violent refutation of the youth's jilting, an argument against such self-serving abandonment. Now the sonnet would read, "Let me, not to the marriage of true minds, admit these so-called impediments. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh, no!" Monmouth could hardly contain his excitement. Everything in the sonnet and in the entire sonnet cycle now clicked into place. Little was left of this marriage of true minds type of love, little except anger, accusations, incriminations, lying, and further infidelity, all of which would be played out by Sonnet 126, by which time the young man and ideal love itself would be abandoned for the slutty pleasures of the dark lady. Monmouth shifted consciousness to the virtual and began encoding an E-note squirt to his faithful interlocutor of the last dozen E-years. And it lights blinked in Monmouth's virtual vision. For a second he thought the Kraken! But the Kraken would never come to the surface or enter an open lead. Monmouth stored the sonnet and his notes, wiped the E-note from his squirt queue, and opened external sensors. The Dark Lady was 5 clicks away from Chaos Central, and in the remote control region of the submarine pens. Monmouth turned the ship over to Central and studied the ice cliffs ahead of him. From the outside, Connemara Chaos Central looked like most of the rest of the surface of Europa, a jumble of pressure ridges thrusting ice cliffs up 200 or 300 meters, the mass of ice blocking the maze of open leads and black lenticulae. But then the signs of habitation became visible, the black maw of the sub-pens opening, the elevators on the cliff face moving, more windows visible on the face of the ice, navigation lights pulsing and blinking atop surface modules and habitation nodes and antennae, and far above, where the cliff ended against black sky, several interlunar shuttles storm-lashed to the landing pad there. Spacecraft here at Chaos Central. Very unusual. Even as Monmouth finished the docking, set his ship's functions on standby, and began separating himself from the submersible's systems, he was thinking, "What the hell have they called me here for?" Docking completed, Monmouth went through the trauma of limiting his senses and control to the awkward confines of his more or less humanoid body, and left the ship, walking into blue-lighted ice and taking the high-speed elevator up to the habitation nodes so far above. 5. Artist Hall. A meal for a dozen people at the table under the lantern-lit tree. Venison and wild boar from the forest, trout from the river below, beef from the cattle herds pastured between Ardis and the Farcaster pad, red and white wines from Ardis vineyards, fresh corn, squash, salad, and peas from the garden, and caviar faxed in from somewhere or the other. "Whose birthday is it and which 20?" asked Damon as servitors passed food to the dozen diners at the long table. "It's my birthday, but not my 20," replied the handsome, curly-haired man named Harmon. "Pardon me?" Damon smiled but did not understand. He accepted some squash and passed the bowl to the lady next to him. "Harmon is celebrating his annual birthday," said Ada from her place at the head of the table. Damon was physically stirred by how beautiful she looked in her tan and black silk gown. Damon shook his head, still not understanding. Annual birthdays were not noted, much less celebrated. "So you're not really celebrating a birth 20 tonight," he said to Harmon, nodding at the floating house servitor to replenish his wine glass. "But I am celebrating my birthday," Harmon repeated with a smile. "My 99th. Damon froze in shock and then looked around quickly, realizing that it must be some kind of joke peculiar to this crowd of provincials, but certainly a joke in bad taste. One did not joke about one's 99th year. Damon smiled thinly and waited for the punchline. "Harmon means it," Ada said lightly. The other guests were silent. Night birds called from the forest. "I'm sorry," Damon managed to say. Harmon shook his head. "I'm looking forward to the year. I have a lot of things to do." "Harmon walked 100 miles of the Atlantic Breach last year," said Hannah, Ada's young friend with the short hair. Damon was sure that he was being joked with now. "One can't walk the Atlantic Breach." "But I did." Harmon was eating corn on the cob. "I only did a reconnaissance, just as Hannah says, 100 miles in and then back to the North American coast. But it certainly wasn't difficult." Damon smiled again to show that he was a good sport. "But how could you get to the Atlantic Breach, Harmon Ur? There are no fax nodes near it." He had no idea where the Atlantic Breach was, or even what constituted North America, and he wasn't quite sure about the location of the Atlantic Ocean. But he was certain that none of the 317 fax nodes were near the breach. He had faxed through each of those nodes more than once, and had never glimpsed the legendary breach. Harmon put down the corn. "I walked, Demon Ur. From the North American eastern coast, the breach runs directly along the 40th parallel, all the way to what the Lost Age humans called Europe. Spain was the last nation-state where the breach comes ashore, I think. The ruins of the old city of Philadelphia. You might know it as Node 124, Loman Ur's estate, is just a few hours' walk from the breach. If I'd had any courage and packed enough food, I could have hiked all the way to Spain." Demon nodded and smiled and had absolutely no idea what this man was babbling about. First, the obscenity of bragging of his 99th year. Then all this talk of parallels and lost age cities and walking. No one walked more than a few hundred yards. Why should they? Everything of human interest lay near a fax node, and those few distant oddities, such as Ada's Ardis, could be reached by carryall or droshky. Demon knew Loman, of course. He had recently celebrated Ono's 30th at the extensive Loman estate. But all the rest of Harmon's soliloquy was gibberish. The man had obviously gone mad in his final days. Well, the final formary fax and ascension would soon take care of that. Demon looked at Ada, their hostess, in hopes that she would intervene to change the topic. But Ada was smiling as if agreeing with everything Harmon had said. Demon looked down the table for help, but the other guests had been listening politely, even with apparent interest, as if such babble were part of their regular provincial dining repartee. "The trout is quite good, isn't it?" he said to the woman on his left. "Was yours good?" A woman across the table, a heavy-set redhead, probably deep into her 30, set her most prominent chin on her small fist and said to Harmon, "What was it like? In the breach, I mean." The curly-haired, deeply tanned man demurred, but others along the table, including the young blonde woman about whose trout Demon had inquired and who had rudely ignored the query, all clamored for Harmon to talk. He finally acquiesced with a graceful motion of his hand. "If you've never seen the breach, it's a fascinating sight just from the shore.
It's about 80 yards wide, a cleft going east as far as one can see, becoming more and more narrow toward the horizon, until it seems just a slice of brightness inset along the line where ocean meets sky. Walking into it is slightly strange. The sand along the beach is not wet where the breach ends. No surf rolls back into it. At first, all of one's attention is focused on one or the other of the edges. Walking into wading depth, you notice the abrupt sheer of water like a glass wall separating the walker from the curl and roll of tide. You have to touch the barrier. No one could resist. Spongy, invisible, very slightly yielding to heavy pressure. Cool from the water on the other side, but impenetrable. You walk deeper on dry sand. Over the centuries, the sea bottom has felt only the moisture of rain, and so the sand and dirt are solid. The remaining sea creatures and plants there are dried out, desiccated, almost to the point of appearing fossilized. Within a dozen yards, the sheared walls of water on both sides rise far over your head. Shadows move within. You see small fish swimming near the barrier between air and sea, then the shadow of a shark, then the pale glow of jellied, floating things you can't quite identify. Sometimes the sea creatures approach the breach barrier, touch it with their cold heads, and then turn away quickly as if alarmed. A mile or so out and the water is so far over your head that the sky above grows darker. A dozen or so miles out and the walls of water on either side rise more than 1,000 feet above you. The stars come out in the slice of sky you can see, even in daylight. "No," said a thin, sandy-haired man far down the table. Damon remembered his name, Lois. "You're joking." "No," said Harmon, "I'm not." He smiled again. "I walked for about 4 days, slept during the night, turned back when I was out of food." "How did you know whether it was night or day?" asked Ada's friend, the athletic young woman named Hannah. "The sky is black and the stars are out in the daytime sky," said Harmon. "But the slices of ocean on either side hold the full band of light, from bright blue far above to murky black along the bottom at the level of the breach walkway."
"Did you find anything exotic?" asked Ada.
"Some sunken ships, ancient, lost age and earlier, and one that might be newer." He smiled again. "I went to explore one of them, a huge, rusted hulk emerging from the north wall of the breach, tilted on its side. I entered through a hole in the hull, climbed ladders, made my way north along tilted floors using a small lantern I'd brought along, until suddenly in one large space, I think it was called a hold, there was the breach barrier from the ceiling to the tilted floor, a wall of water, alive with fish. I sat my face against the cold, invisible wall and could see barnacles, mollusks, sea snakes and life forms encrusting every surface, feeding on one another, while on my side, dryness, old rust, the only living things consisting of me and a small white land crab that had obviously migrated, as I had, from the shore. A wind came up and rustled the leaves in the tall tree above them. Lanterns swayed and their rich light played across the silk and cotton clothing and hairdos and the hands and warmly lighted faces around the table. Everyone was rapt. Even Demon found himself interested, despite the fact that it was all nonsense. Torches and braziers along the walkway flickered and crackled in the sudden breeze. "What about the Voynix?" asked a woman sitting next to Lois. Demon could not remember her name. "M.A., perhaps. Are there more or fewer than on land? Sentinels or Motal?" "No Voynix." Everyone at the table seemed to take a breath. Demon felt the same sudden surge of shock he'd experienced when Harmon had announced that it was his 99th year. He felt a surge of vertigo. Perhaps the wine had been stronger than he thought.
"No Voynix," repeated Ada, in a tone not so much of wonder but of wistfulness.
She raised her glass of wine. "A toast," she said. Servitors floated closer to fill glasses. Everyone raised his or her own glass. Demon blinked away the dizziness and forced a pleasant, sociable smile into place. Ada did not announce a toast, but everyone, even after a moment, Demon, drank the wine as if she had. The wind had come up by the end of the meal, clouds moving in to obscure the P and E rings, and the air smelled of ozone and of the curtains of rain dragging across the dark hills to the west. So the party moved inside, and then broke up as couples wandered off to their rooms or to various wings and rooms for entertainment. Servitors produced chamber music in the South Conservatory. The glassed-in swimming pool to the rear of the manor attracted a few people, and there was a midnight buffet laid out in the curved bay of the second-floor observation porch. Some couples went to their private rooms to make love, while others found a quiet place to unfold their Turins and to go to Troy. Damon followed Ada, who had led Hannah and the man named Harmon to the third-story library. If Damon's plan of seducing Ada before the weekend was over was to succeed, he had to spend every free minute with her. Seduction, he knew, was both science and art, a blend of skill, discipline, proximity, and opportunity. Mostly proximity. Standing and walking near her, Damon could feel the warmth of her skin through the tan and black silk she wore. Her lower lip, he noticed again after a decade, was maddeningly full, red, and meant for biting. When she raised her arm to show Harmon and Hannah the height of shelves in the library, Damon watched the subtle, soft shift of her right breast under its thin sheath of silk. He had been in a library before, but never one this large. The room must have been more than 100 feet long and half that high, with a mezzanine running around three walls and sliding ladders on both levels to give access to the higher and more remote volumes. There were alcoves, cubbies, tables with large books opened on them, seating areas here and there, and even shelves of books over the huge bay window on the far wall. Damon knew that the physical books stored here must have been treated with non-decompositive nanochemicals many, many centuries before, probably millennia ago. These useless artifacts were made of leather and paper and ink, for heaven's sake. But the mahogany-paneled room with its pools of source lighting, ancient leather furniture and brooding walls of books still smelled of age and decay to Demon's sensitive snout. He could not imagine why Ada and the other family members maintained this mausoleum at Artis Hall, or why Harmon and Hannah wanted to see it tonight. The curly-haired man who claimed to be in his last year and who claimed to have walked into the Atlantic Breach stopped in wonder. "It's wonderful, Ada." End of side one.